Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Dr. Robert Kleinhens. Dr. Kleinhens directs the Kaiser Center for Economic Research, which conducts research on the regional, state, and national economies. He has over 25 years of experience and expertise in the private and public sectors, academia, and working as a private consultant. Dr. Kleinhens has spoken to state, local, and national audiences, and is a frequent contributor to media coverage on the economy. He has a master's and doctorate degree from USC, all in economics. And Dr. Kleinhens, we welcome you back to our show.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Bruce.
I think the last thing we touched on was the subject of uncertainty. And taking a look at real estate volume, you know, there was an expectation we were going to be in the mid-400s. And for most of the year, except for the last month, we've been around the mid-300s. And so maybe just discuss a little bit about the role that uncertainty plays in somebody saying, I just am not comfortable making a decision.
Yeah, it's important both for households and for businesses to understand what's out there. And if they don't understand it, or if they're not certain or have some sense of where things are going, then in many instances, the best strategy is to just sit on your hands and do nothing. So I think that to some extent, that is the set of circumstances we're facing in housing, both in the existing home market and in the new home market. On the existing home market side of things, I think would-be sellers have been reluctant to put their homes up for sale because they're hearing mixed signals about what's happening in the housing market. We have seen the rate of price appreciation slow, so they may have been able to recover some of the lost equity from the Great Recession and housing crisis in 2012 and 2013. They may have been able to recover some of that lost equity. In 2014, they may not be sure of what direction the housing market's going to take. So on the supply side for existing homes, I think home sellers are somewhat reticent to list this year, counter to what I was expecting. On the supply of new homes side of things, they're going to take their cues from what's happening in the existing home market to some extent, what's happening with price gains, what's happening with sales volume. And so I think there's a spillover effect that's working against the new home market and builders at the present time. And then on the consumer side, the buyer side of the equation, or the demand side, everything they hear about the housing market right now suggests that prices are going up, so affordability, by their calculations, is only getting worse. Usually that creates a sense of urgency, at least for a period of time, that individuals or households try to get a home before home prices go up any higher. But I don't sense that that's happening right now. And I suppose you could argue that the low interest rate environment, especially the recent drop in interest rates, may be reducing some of that uncertainty, some of that urgency to get out there and buy a home. So all of the players right now, I think, are dealing with set of market conditions that really is full of uncertainty. And while there are certain fundamentals that seem to be working in favor of the housing market, things aren't quite moving where we think they should be here in 2014.
When you take a look at a builder, the one thing that they have to have is they have to have certainty as far as what's on the horizon, because they're in for a kind of a stretch of time. So if they decide, I'm going to buy a piece of land and we're going to convert it into building lots and then we're going to build on them, they're talking about at least a three-year horizon. And I think that might be missing for them.
Well, so that's a good point. If you take a look at some of the longer-term calculations about new household formation nationally as well as here in the state of California, all signs really point to an increased need for new homes. We're seeing that as the economy gets better, younger members of households, but working members of households, maybe leaving their parents' household and forming their own household, maybe renting initially, but possibly buying. And that should be a growing trend over the next few years. At the national level, it's estimated by some that we should be forming households at a rate of about 1.7 million per year, and we're only adding a little bit more than a million units per year, or at least the expectations are that we'll be adding about a million units plus or minus this year and the next couple of years. So that suggests that the long-term prospects for builders ought to be positive, that there's going to be demand for that product when it finally reaches the market.
The lenders also have a little bit of a problem because a lot of the fines that they're being asked to pay for actions in 2006 and 2007, the fines are just coming down the pike, and they're not small. And I'm wondering if they're not also uncertain about, okay, what can we safely do? What are the rules of engagement, and what are we going to not get fined? what programs are safe enough for us to do to where we're not worried about getting fined anymore?
Well, so I'm not a financial institutions expert, but I think that it's safe to say or to observe that the capital requirements for lending institutions have been increased. So they have to hold more capital in reserves against their deposits as a result of Dodd-Frank and the regulations that apply to the various lending institutions around the country. So that is making it more difficult for them to lend out as much, you know, the same volume that they may have been able to lend out before. On top of that, I think that you would find that they are also basically facing stiffer standards when it comes to whom they can lend money out. So they're going to be very reticent to lend out to businesses, to developers, as well as to consumers who have any hint of being an above normal credit risk. That would be my take on the situation as well, I mean, at this time. But then, as you point out, at least some institutions, the bigger institutions, have fines that they've either paid or they anticipate paying, or some other kinds of outcomes of legal action that is still pending that may lead them to hold back from really fully becoming involved in getting the wheels of the economy going again.
When you're an employer and you look at the future and see uncertainty, how do you react as far as staff? What generally do you do?
Well, I think the first thing you're going to do is you're going to look at your current staffing and see how long you can go and how far you can stretch yourself with your existing staff, initially with your full-time staff and your part-time staff. If you see that you're going to be able to increase your activity, your sales, then you're probably going to rely first on increases in part-time staffing to the extent that that's even a feasible solution. And then at some point, the increases that you reap from increasing your part-time staff only go so far, and it's usually at that point when you realize that you need to add additional full-timers. And I do think that we're just about at the point in this economic cycle where we ought to see increases in full-time staffing over and above what we have been seeing for the last couple of years. The wild card here is just exactly how firms in various industries are responding to the Affordable Care Act requirements.
Okay. If you're an employee and you have uncertainty, how does that change your habit as far as being an employee? What do you do? What don't you do?
Well, I think during the worst of the recession, when uncertainty was greatest, many employees who might have thought about changing jobs under normal circumstances simply hunkered down and decided to stick with their current employer until it seemed as though the coast was clear. So we're in no way back in circumstances that we faced a few years ago during the worst days of the recession. There's a lot more mobility in the labor market today than there was a few years ago, both in terms of job openings, so there are options for people who want to change jobs, and also to your question, the willingness on the part of employees to actually get out there and change jobs. But if there is some sense that the outlook over the next few months is uncertain or less certain than it was in the last 6 months, I think people will be moving a little bit more cautiously than they otherwise would.
What is the effect of having a minimum wage hike? And is the hike, let's say, in Seattle, a significant event for them in any and is there any connective tissue to, okay, let's say Seattle has a $15 an hour minimum wage, I'm going to migrate there?
That's a good point, that if there's a higher minimum wage in one metropolitan area, perhaps it will attract workers from out of the area. The theory behind those who are proponents of higher minimum wage is that if you can enable more people in your local economy to earn more, they're going to spend more, and that's going to help to support the local economy. The real question, though, is whether or not that's going to have an adverse impact on hiring as a whole. And I think in a thriving local economy where you clearly have a lot more businesses demanding employees, especially at that sort of entry level and low wage tier, a lot more firms are demanding those employees than there are employees to fill those positions, you can probably have an increase in the minimum wage and little or no adverse impact on employment. In a place like Los Angeles County, I'm not sure that would work out the same way, nor in other parts of Southern California, notably the Inland Empire. And then, of course, the standard theory that most economists adhere to is that if you're going to raise the price on something, people or businesses are going to want to buy less of it. So in the labor market, that translates into lower overall employment in the very simple analysis of how labor markets respond to higher minimum wages.
What happens to the people that are currently making, let's say, I'll just pick on a fast food. Let's say you work at a fast food place and whatever the minimum wage is, I don't know what it is in California. Do you know what it is?
I think it's $8, soon to go up to $9, but don't quote me on that.
Okay, let's just ballpark. Let's say it's $9 and you have a $15 an hour worker, and then there's going to be a minimum wage raised to $15 in the next so many years. What generally happens to the people that are already, you know, they've been there for a long time making $15? Do they keep that spread from from the $9 to $15? Do now they make $21? And how inflationary is that?
Well, so here in California, the minimum wage right now is $8, but it's going to go up to $9 per hour effective July 1st of this year, and then it's going to go up to $10 an hour a year from now in 2016, actually. I think that different businesses react to the increases in minimum wage and how that creates a sort of an accordion effect throughout the wage structure of their employees. It really, from what I can tell, it does seem to depend on the employer and the employer's ability to react to the higher cost of the lower wage workers. So, just looking at things objectively, you may be paying what you think is a fair wage for an employee in a particular capacity, and then all of a sudden, with a higher minimum wage, the person below that employee that you think is being paid fairly, the person below that is getting a higher wage, and that gap between the two narrows, your ability to make adjustments to that employee's fair wage really depends on how much margin you have to work with. We're in a very competitive set of economic conditions at the present time. I think profit margins for a lot of industries are pretty narrow. They're probably growing vis-a-vis where we were a few years ago. But I think they're still profit margins are still under pressure. I think it's hard to say just exactly how firms across the board are going to respond, whether or not they're going to uniformly raise the entire wage structure as a minimum wage increase goes into effect, or if they're going to have to sort of test the water and see what the market will bear.
Does a minimum wage increase, does that have a big effect on, let's say, manufacturing? And if it really raised the cost of manufacturing, how would that affect its competitiveness, the United States or California's competitiveness with foreign countries trying to produce some very similar goods?
Well, I think I don't know the answer to that question directly, but I can at least conjecture that an increase of the minimum wage by about $1 an hour, in the case of manufacturing, it probably does squeeze profit margins. To the credit of manufacturers in the United States, this sector of the economy has been very good at harnessing technology to economize, to save on costs, and oftentimes that means automation is going to displace workers. So if we're seeing an increase in the manufacturing wage to a worker in a factory, there will be an incentive for the owner of that factory to figure out a cheaper way to make things. It could mean displacing some workers with increased use of technology and automation. But even that takes some time to bring into effect. So this technology piece, I think, is really working in the favor of the manufacturing sector in the United States right now. Never thought we'd be able to make that observation. And it doesn't happen in a vacuum. So many of our goods are being manufactured in places like China and other parts of Southeast Asia, where wages are much lower than they are here, but the gap between the two is shrinking. And we're hearing increasingly about the reshoring of at least some manufacturing here to the United States.
Let's talk about an index I've never heard before. Is it Gini, G-I-N-I index?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is that?
It's the Gini coefficient measures the extent to which economies have income inequality or income equality. So if all of the wealth of a national economy happened to be in the hands of one person, then the Gini coefficient would be one. If it's the more spread out the distribution of wealth is across the population in a given economy, the lower that Gini coefficient is going to be.
Okay. So what would we consider a healthy Gini index?
I'm not sure if there's a an accepted norm. Typically, what is seen in the academic and other kind of literature on the distribution of income is sort of a comparison across countries, and in a comparison over time. So, in the last 20 years or so, the Gini coefficient for the United States has increased, meaning that the wealth has become increasingly concentrated in the hands of fewer people. But the fact of the matter is we go through long waves in our economic and demographic cycles where the distribution of income changes quite markedly. And so right now it's that concentration is growing, has been for maybe 20 years or so. I think a lot of that owes to this long wave of information technology that continue. It really dates back to perhaps the advent of the PC a little bit before the 1980 mark and continued with the Internet revolution. And today we have social media. So many of these developments on the technology and Internet and social media front continue to change the way people do business, and it also changes the compensation patterns to workers in our economy. But I would imagine that we look out another 10 or 15 years, and that Gini coefficient is probably going to edge down.
Okay. That does seem to be the intent for a lot of politicians, and maybe it's like you say, maybe it's just part of the natural cycle of things. How do foreign economies affect a state like California or an area like Los Angeles? And how well can you predict what their changes might be?
California and Southern California are both very much reliant on the United States trade relationship with major trading partners, partly because a number of things that are made in the United States actually are made here. So, I mean, I would, or at least their headquarters are here. So the obvious names that come to mind generally, going back to what we were just talking about, generally are in areas of technology, information technology, beginning, of course, with Apple, but you've got HP and any number of other companies that have headquarters here. So on that front, and that's largely, we're largely talking about manufacturers, what is good for our trading partners oftentimes is good for the California and Southern California economies. Similarly, as many economies around the world are industrializing and becoming more developed, the standard of living improves, and they turn to the United States and look to us for all sorts of products that reflect a more affluent lifestyle. They come to California as tourists. They go to local movie theaters and view movies that were made in California and in Southern California. So there are many linkages between the economies here in the state of California and locally, between these areas here and so many of our trading partners around the globe.
In Japan in the 70s, had a tremendous real estate boom, and I think that went through till the end of the 80s, and then that had a big problem. And the Japanese used to invest in a lot of California real estate, and that's basically, they've been replaced by other countries, one of them being China. So right now, there's rumor that China has a real estate bubble. A lot of Chinese investors are pushing money into the California market, and they are a fairly healthy percentage of what's being purchased. Do you consider that any problem as far as if they in fact do have a bubble burst over there, and what would the effect be in our market?
Well, so there is concern about a bubble in Chinese real estate. You're absolutely right. There, for a period of time, there was pretty easy access to capital for the purchase and building, for the building of and not just residential, but also all types of non-residential properties. So that access to capital has been tightened over the last year or so. And so that may, and the Chinese government, based on what I have been reading, is trying to, you know, contract that and take the wind take the air out of that bubble, if you will, so as to not cause collapse in the Chinese real estate markets. But you're right. Meanwhile, at least some of that money that would otherwise have been invested in Chinese real estate is making its way across the Pacific over here to Southern California in particular. So many parcels here in the downtown L.A. area where my office is located have been purchased by Chinese investors, either private or by government real estate investment companies. And so they view this as very favorable here in Southern California. Keep in mind that the biggest cities here in California are just nowhere close in size to the metropolises of Shanghai and Beijing and China. So real estate on a price per square foot basis is pretty cheap here compared to there. And there's a lot of upside, so this is a pretty attractive place.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time. We've been speaking with Dr. Robert Kleinhens and with the Kaiser Center for Economic Research. Thanks for taking time to be with us for a couple of shows. I really appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure, Bruce. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.